Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Data Centricity, a key to automation of the processes of a drilling rig. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Mark Carrier with RTI. Mark brings over 12 years of upstream and downstream oil and gas experience and a passion for building and designing federated distributed systems to his role as Market Development Director at RTI. Prior to joining RTI, he was the Chief System Architect and Technical Manager for National Oil Well Varco and the Systems Architect of the System Energy Drilling Automation Platform for Ensign. Mark was also a key contributor to ION Geophysical's 80,000 channel count seismic recorder, which at the time was the largest recorder built. Mark graduated from the Indiana University of Pennsylvania with a BS in computer science. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. Your console consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, and resize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenter. In the presenter's window, a biography and a presentation slides, and a Q&A window that enables you to participate today. There are a set of seven icons across the bottom of the screen. Clicking on the icon on the far left will reset your viewing area to the default configuration. The rest of the icons will open and close their corresponding window. Now, you can hover over your mouse on each window, and it'll show what it controls. The handout icon, third from the right, opens a handout window, which has the presenter's slides in PDF form you can use to follow along with or download for future reference. Now, that Q&A window enables you to participate in today. You can simply type your question into the Ask a Question text box and then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event while the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help you. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Without further ado, let's get to the presentation. Mark, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Kurt, and good afternoon. My name is Mark Carrier, and I am a Market Development Director for Oil and Gas and Process Automation at RTI. And today I want to talk to you about why data centricity is the key to automating the process of a drilling rig. So today I want to talk about a few things. I'm going to talk about the industrial Internet of Things revolution and how this will shape our world in the future. I want to talk about software disruption and why this is important. I'll give you an overview of the three major market segments in oil and gas. My focus today will be on the upstream, and I will talk about how these market sectors communicate today and how data centricity can revolutionize and change how these sectors communicate in the future. So I'll give you an example of how you actually use a data bus to achieve autonomy. We'll touch on using data centricity to scale to a digital oil field. And then lastly, we'll talk about RTI DDS and the technology that's required to achieve what we're talking about today. So in 2013, Gartner made a statement that says the machine era will be the most disruptive in the history of IT. So what does this mean? It means that machines are becoming smarter, and we need the ability to make these machines to be able to communicate with each other. So why do we want to do that? Because by having smarter machines, we can have better and safer infrastructure around us in our lives. So what is the industrial Internet of Things disruption? Almost every industry will be dealing with the exploding amount of digital data. So the real value to this is a common architecture that connects sensors to clouds and interoperates between vendors and spans industries. So to give you a few examples of some industries, so the upstream oil and gas segment right now is going through the biggest transformation since the introduction of directional drilling in the 20s. The digital oil field and autonomous drilling rigs will forever change the landscape of the industry. So if you think about a drilling rig today, a successful rig operation requires management of an exploding amount of digital data. So an average rig operation produces gigabytes of raw machine process and procedural data every day. And to kind of give you some perspective on that, in the height of land drilling in 2014, we had almost 1,900 active rigs in 2015, that collapsed down to about 500-600. Now we're up around 1,200 again. So that's an immense amount of data that we're producing. So if you look at healthcare, nowadays a successful treatment for an average monitored patient produces about 1.5 gigabyte of raw physiological data a day. And the automotive industry is going through the biggest transformation since the introduction of the car. So connected cars and autonomous driving are going to completely revolutionize transportation as we know it. So this means that there's an exciting opportunity to apply the same technology across all industries, and this is exactly why there are organizations like the IIC, which are focused on common standards and architectures across all industries. So IIoT system architecture commonality. So while the range of all of these applications is very, very broad, but if you look under the hood at these applications, they all share a very common architecture. They're all distributed control systems, which are composed of sensors, actuators, real-time analytics, HMIs, loggers, machine learning, artificial intelligence. And then most of these applications can really be defined as systems of systems. And these systems of systems involve device-to-device communication. They involve device-to-IT integration to the cloud or on the premises. And primarily, this communication is used for optimization and predictive maintenance. But what is the one thing that all of these architecture, or I'm sorry, all these systems have in common is that they're driven by data. So what is the disruption that's going on right now? It's software. And software is eating the world. So now a fundamental competitive differentiation that all industries have is software, and software is becoming everything to all industries. So let's talk about drilling for an example. A drilling rig is really a mechanical tool. There's no software in it at all other than the control system. But about 10 years ago, there was software that was introduced into the drilling rig to help optimize some of the procedures that were happening. We had auto drillers. These were used to maintain set points while drilling. Soft torque, which is a vibration mitigation algorithm to provide smoother well bores. We have friction braking algorithms used to help automate and optimize the steering process. But you can't easily integrate these into a mechanical rig. So the question is, how will all these components seamlessly connect together? And how can you connect them to the cloud? And it's not an easy task, but it's becoming very critical in the world that we live in today. So if you do anything technical, then you need to learn software. If you do anything non-technical, well, then you'll be using software. So let's take a quick overview of the three major markets, market segments in oil and gas, and explore how software can help revolutionize this market space. So I'll just give you a quick overview of the three segments, but like I said earlier, my presentation is going to focus solely on the upstream market. So upstream, which is traditionally known as the exploration and production segment, the upstream encompasses all the activities that are related to, searching for, recovering, and producing crude oil or natural gas. So the upstream market segment is really about a well. So it's where to locate them, how deep and how far to drill them, how to design, construct, operate, and manage them, all to deliver the greatest possible return on investment with the lightest and safest, smallest operational footprint. We have the midstream market segment, which is really the vital link between the producing areas and the population centers where industrial, refining, and residential customers are located. And midstream is really about field gathering. So transmission pipelines and processing plants are the major assets that you'll find in the midstream industry. And downstream is about processing, transporting, and selling refined products that are made from crude oil. So some of the key downstream businesses are oil refining, supply and trading, product marketing and retail. So the downstream industry provides thousands of products to end users and customers around the globe. And some of the familiar products that we get from this are gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, heating oil. some of the not-so-familiar products that we see are lubricants, synthetic rubber, plastics, fertilizers, pesticides. Let's skip over these next couple slides. So let's talk about the current structure of the upstream market segment. So the upstream market is traditionally defined by four market sectors. We have the operators, the contractors, service companies, and the vendors. So the operator is the company that serves as the overall manager and decision maker of a drilling project. So generally, but not always, the operator will have the largest financial stake in the project. Now, the contractor is the company that owns and operates a drilling rig. So a drilling contractor usually charges a fixed daily rate for the rig, its crew, and then any other extraordinary expenses, which means that the cost of the well is largely a function of the time that it takes to drill and complete the well. Now, service companies fill the supply gaps for the contractors and operators. And these can include many, many different physical products as well as services, such as logistics, supply chain, software, and training. So these service companies usually get called out to the rig to assist the contractors in performing specific duties that are required by the operators. And lastly, we have the vendor. So the vendor is responsible for manufacturing and selling of the equipment, which are used by the other entities within the market segment. So all of these companies together provide a critical service for the production of oil and gas. So what's the problem with the structure that we have today? Is that there is no cohesive way for any of these entities for sharing real-time machine or process data. So integration is costly and time-consuming, which usually means it's an engineering effort and not a software architecture. There are no standards for players to measure key performance indicators. There's no standard industry data model or no standard industry communication protocols, which means that we lack quality of service on the data. There's no standard on engineering units. Data is traditionally time series when it's coming from a rig, which means that it doesn't provide any context. So what we get in the end is a goal that's very, very high cost for both integration. So how do we actually add a data-centric integration of upstream? So what is software and the DDS bus were used to provide an additional integration platform? So what would this new structure look like? Well, we could have a standard industry data model that could be developed. We could have standard KPIs to measure the efficiency and reduce costs. Subscribing to data would be just as easy as specifying which data you would like to receive. So engineering units would now be part of the standard data model, so you know what unit your data is actually in. Data would now be presented in context, which gives us a real-time view of the process. So this provides a common protocol to access data. And data can be represented now in two states, which is data in motion and data at rest. So if we need to look at historical data, we have a single unified interface, which is the same interface that we would look at for future data, which we call data in motion. And then the integration and cost would be drastically reduced, resulting in a goal that's much easier to reach. It has a significant reduction in cost and time for all sectors of the market segments. There's a new integration platform, which paves the way for technologies. So, a message-centric view of a drilling rig. So, what is the message? Why does a message-centric approach fail? So let's look at the data that we have here on the screen. So data today is produced usually in what we call time series format. So here we're looking at three machines working in concert on the rig that are producing time series data. So we have a circulation system, a hoisting system, and a rotation system. So there's no context to the data whatsoever. So there's really no understanding of what's going on process-wise. And also the values that we're looking at, we don't know what the engineering units are of those. So if we want to see what's going on for analytics or apply any kind of AI or machine learning, at first we have to give the data the context, which means we have to run a bunch of models on it, filter it, clean it up, and then we can build those models and but all this is actually done on historical data, so it's not very easy to apply to a real-time situation. So if we take a different view of the rig, we take a data-centric view, why does a data-centric approach work over a message-centric approach? Because data is now logged in context, which means we know exactly what's going on in real time. So again, we have three machines working together in concert. We have the circulation system, a hoisting system, and a rotation system. But this time, we know that they're all working together to achieve a single objective, which in this case is drilling. So now, in real time, we can apply AI and machine learning algorithms, and we can use the results of those to dynamically change the objectives or goals of the rig if we need to. So we can look at analytics in real time and understand the issues in real time. So we can not only do this on a single rig, but we can do it on a fleet of rigs, and we can do that in real time. So if an operator or a contractor sees an issue on one rig, then he can immediately make sure that the other rigs are aware of the problem and adjust their plans accordingly. So now let's talk about some edge autonomy. So what I want to talk about is actually how do you use a database to achieve autonomy? So typically, we have three ways to architect a system. We can take a centralized view, a decentralized, or a distributed. So centralized defines a hierarchy decision making structure where all decisions and processes are handled strictly at some centralized place. So this creates a highly coupled system with very weak cohesion. So it's not very good for autonomy, and the central point of failure is often not enough visibility to make an optimal decision. A decentralized approach, it removes the central design, but it organizes the system into a bunch of delegates, which actually still provides a hierarchical structure in nature, but it gives a little more autonomy to the individual subsystems of the overall system. Distributed, this is where it's a truly federated system, which gives each component of the system authority and responsibility for the task that it's performing. So this provides an extremely loosely coupled system with very, very strong cohesion. And this provides the right architecture that we need for autonomy. So there's no single point of failure in this system. The system can still function if we lose a component of the system. It may not function as well, but we still don't lose the entire system. So actually, let's take all three of these concepts, and I want to apply it to a real-world example on a drilling rig. So this is going to be a very simple example where we're going to have a bunch of data being produced by the sensors, and then we're going to determine that we're getting too much accumulation of cuttings, which could result in a stuck pipe if we don't. One of the ways to mitigate that would be to clean the hole. So let's kind of walk through those exercises. So in centralized processing, involves pushing raw data from sensors to the rig to the cloud. So then the cloud processes the data based on AI, machine learning algorithms, or other models. And then the decision is made based on the current state of the rig and then sent back to the rig. But the rig may actually receive that data at the wrong time, which means the rig has ended up in a bad state. So why did the cloud fail to make the right decision at that time? It's because the delay time in transferring the data, which is not actually the biggest issue, but it can play into it. But the cloud needs to get data from other sources, so it needs to aggregate data from all over the place. It needs to filter that data. It needs to put it into context, and it needs to run the algorithms and models and make a decision. So by the time the decision is made and sent back to the rig could potentially already be in a bad state. All right, so let's talk about edge processing, which is the decentralized. So edge processing allows a rig to process the sensor data and build some events based on local models. So these events can then be published back to the cloud where AI, machine learning, and algorithms or other models can be run on that data to produce a result. So a decision can be made based on the current state of the rig and then sent back to the rig. So the rig receives a new objective, but this time, again, the rig could be in a bad state. So why did the cloud in this state fail to make the right decision? Again, the delay in transferring data for processing is an issue, but not a major issue. But the cloud, again, needs to get data from other sources. So even though it's now receiving events or models instead of just raw sensor data, it still needs to filter all those events, run algorithms and models, and then make a good decision. And by the time it does that and then sends it back, the rig may again already be in a bad state. So if we look at edge autonomy is a completely distributed federated system. And edge autonomy allows the rig to process the sensor data and then locally run all the AI and machine learning algorithms or other models. So a decision can be made and based locally on the current environment of the rig. So this allows the rig to determine a new objective and avoid getting itself into a bad state. And then once the rig has made a decision about what it decided to do, it can then send those results back to the cloud for analysis and also learning. And this allows those learned behavior to be applied to other rigs in the field. So why is this approach the right approach, and why did it make the right decision? It's because all the data that's required to make a decision was available locally. So all the processing can be done in real time, and any real-time environment changes that are happening are also detected in real time and can be fed back into the loop. So actually I'm going to talk about using a data centricity to scale to a digital oil field. So why is this the right architecture? So the Industrial Internet Consortium has defined an architecture called the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture, which is a layered data bus. The layered data bus allows you to apply autonomy to the different parts of the rig where we need the autonomy. So all of the machine processing can be segregated from the process layer. So what we do is we have a layered data bus. So if you look at the picture here, we have a sensor data, and that's all feeding into processes that are managing the subsystems underneath it. On top of that, we have another layer data bus, which happens to be the DDS data bus in this layer. So there's a different data model in there. And then we have processes running around that, which communicate with the data associated at the process layer. And at the enterprise layer, we can also represent another data bus. And the reason that this is important is because that each level within the system, the data has different qualities and different needs associated with it. So at the sensor level, it's usually much more high-speed data, probably more reliable data needed. And as we move up the stack, we're not actually looking at sensor data anymore, but we're looking at aggregated meaning of that data. So it allows us to express each layer of the data bus with a different data model, and then each data model can have a set of quality of service attributes associated with it. So by the time we get to the enterprise level, we don't really need to be looking at machine data anymore because the machine's already done a lot of the processing and the edge analytics. What we're looking at is events. And then those predictive analysis, condition-based monitoring, those are the type of events that we want to propagate up to the cloud, not the actual machine data. So this allows us to completely redesign a rig instead of a control-centric or message-centric way. Is now we can create an architecture based on what drilling is. So this allows the automation system to be adaptable and flexible because it's built on a drilling process and not on a machine control process. And this allows some pretty cool things. You can have self-commissioning, the system over time as the mechanics of the system become more automated, you can grow into a full automation system. So today we have these very monolithic systems, which are all tied and tightly coupled together But this type of architecture allows us to evolve to a fully decoupled, federated architecture. So, let's look at the digital oil field for a little bit. By applying that same architecture, we can now start to lay out each rig instead of a physical component in the field. We can have one data bus that ties all of the rigs together in the field. So now this allows a lot of things. First, a rig can communicate with other rigs to exchange information. So if contractor A has multiple rigs working in a region, and he's experiencing some kind of vibration, which is excessive because of the formation or unexpected events, that data can then be real-time communicated to other rigs within the same area, or even globally, because each area is so different. And you have drillers that are experienced in drilling in one area but not experienced in another. So now what we can do is start to broaden this knowledge. So you could actually allow drillers to move to an oversight role, and actually, instead of working in one area for their entire life, now they could just start to move around different parts of the globe. And as the environment changes, really they're just managing the oversight the process of the rig. So they're moved to more of an oversight role. Another thing that happens here is an operator traditionally works with many different contractors, and all of these contractors have different sets of tools. They have different ways of gathering and sending data, different types of data recorders. Now, we have taken a lot of advancement with data aggregators. So there are companies out there that do a lot of this. They've tried to put together some standard data models so that operator A can work with contractor A, B, and C and still get data. But the problem is the frequency of the data is always historical in nature. So if you want to move autonomous behavior down to the drill floor, it becomes very, very, very difficult to do that. So things like this contractor A is drilling, and he's seen some excessive bit wear, and it's beyond like the normal operations or what they normally expected to see. They can the autonomous system can then look at other environmental characteristics which might be feeding into that, and then alert other rigs, other that contractor A owns, to let them know about some predictive maintenance. So the predictive maintenance is no longer just isolated to the drill floor. It can actually be isolated to the entire drilling field. This is also true from an operator standpoint, because operators are very interested in key performance indicators. Downtime is one thing that they don't like. They want to keep the operations going. They want to do it in a very safe and efficient manner. But when you're working with different contractors, different sets of rules, different equipment, different ways of running things, it's very hard to do that. But if you express everything as data, and the operator is then looking at the same data sets from each different contractor that he's working at, and it kind of levels the playing field and gives you a more equal understanding or a better understanding of what's going on. Another thing that's really important about that is the visualization tools. Traditionally, they're different from environment to environment. A contractor itself may have different equipment from different vendors. So if you go from one rig to another rig, depending on what vendors you're using, you may have different HMIs that you're looking at. You may have different web portals that you're using and looking at your data. So you may have a web portal from service company A and then a web company from service portal B. You've got them up on monitors. They have very different look and feels. The data is the same, but learning how to use those, how to navigate them, is very different. So by looking at things just as data instead of control, it gives you a much, much different way of solving the problem. So let's carry this example a little bit further of the digital oil field, because this is where it gets really interesting. So we talked about using our layered data bus for different contractors to kind of connect the rigs together. But now what we can start to do is bring in service companies as well. And service companies, like I said earlier, they provide services outside of the actual drilling. So fracking is one. There's seismic analysis. There's reservoir modeling. And all this typically happens with very disparate sets of data. So it's very time consuming. So as data is collected in this time series process that we talked about, it's brought back, it's filtered, it's conditioned, context is given to the model, it's cleaned up, models are built and constantly refined and tuned. So this allows, the digital oil field allows us to bring all of this together under one umbrella. So now if I actually have seismic data, my rig, so the well construction or engineer who's decided or defined the well plan, and he's worked with many different people. They looked at seismic data. They've looked at wells that have been drilled in that area, so they have a much better fidelity understanding of the formation or the types of things that they will encounter along the way. But now by tying this together in real time, I could take seismic data, and I could feed that model into the rig. So with a well plan, I could also validate that. And then as I'm drilling, I can also produce the as-drilled data back into reservoir modeling. This is very important, especially when you get into fracking. Now, this is an area that I'm not an expert in, so I'm just going to kind of give you a high-level view or idea about what you can do with that. So one thing while we're drilling is they're always cautious about the formation. You don't want to fracture it. You don't want to destroy it. So there's a lot of processes that they go through for drilling, and then they case it and then cement it, just trying to seal the wellbore itself off from the earth around it. But now you can start to build these mechanical earth models so that the fracking and the reservoir modeling and the drilling, they all become very dynamic. And instead of the information, be it at separate companies and shared, it's a very, very low fidelity. Now you can start to bring the fidelity of all of that back together under one umbrella in more real time. And this is a huge, huge cost savings for everyone. It also improves safety. It does a lot of things. So let's talk about the technology for a little bit that's required to do this. I'm going to talk about the evolution of a data bus. So a data bus is data-centric in nature, and it's really the fourth generation of disruptive networking technologies. So what does that mean? So it means in the beginning, we had a point-to-point, and this is essentially TCP, or kind of the way a telephone works. So this doesn't branch. It's very hard. You can only have communication between two entities. The next evolution was that of client-server. So this branches very well, but there's also a lot of choke points. So some typical technologies that we see for that are file systems, database, remote procedure calls, CORBA. You know, this is good if information is naturally centralized, but it's also a single point of failure like we talked about in the centralized architecture. And it also has the possibility for performance bottlenecks. So it has a very, very slow failover. And then we evolve to a publish subscribe by messages. So this branches really well. There's no bottlenecks, but the problem with this is there's no data model. So everything is still passed through messages. And then we evolve to queuing, which extends the publish subscribed concept to an abstract so that receptors can sequence endpoints for load balancing. which also led to publish subscribe with data replication. But really, the data bus is, like I said, the fourth generation of networking technology. Is about data centricity. So what it means now is that we create this global database that's visible to anybody in the system. And instead of subscribing to a message, the problem with messages is they disregard the data. So data is really an afterthought. But distributed IIoT systems are all about the data. So that's why you need a very different technology if you're going to build an IIoT system. So at RTI, we sell a data bus. And a data bus is a very, very, very powerful tool because it implies this whole concept of data centricity. So data-centric technology connects applications to the data, not applications to applications. So this is very important because what it allows you to do is remove the knowledge of one player to another or to another player. It resolves the problem of redundant source sinks. It allows you to hide your startup order, locators. They find each other by relationships. So another thing that it adds is control flow. And this is very important when you're talking about networking technology. Because flow control is at the heart of what networking technology is all about. It's about getting data to the right place at the right time. So that's really what data centricity is all about. So let's talk about database and the data bus. So they're both data centric. But a database is about historical data. And a data bus is about future data. So a data bus is about expressing the system in the terms of data and observing those state changes on the data. So traditional systems are communicating data through messages, and the data is really, like I said earlier, it's just an afterthought. But these new systems are really all about data. So the only way that it makes sense to integrate them is through the data and not messages. So a data bus, it provides a common source of truth for all entities in the system. And it is really the only way to build a large scale system. Now, databases guarantee no corruption on the data, which is great, but they're really also about historical data. The data bus guarantees fresh data. It has timing rates, reliability, security, and it's all about future data. So you wouldn't dream of implementing an enterprise system without a database, so you should not ever dream about implementing an IIoT system without a data bus. So what we do at RTI is we enable a data everywhere abstraction. So there's a couple things that I said earlier that we provide a global data space to all entities in the system. Well, we don't actually send all of the data to all the entities. Every application in the system just really gets the data that it needs and when it needs it. So applications, instead of sending messages, what they do is they declare their needs and capabilities, and the data bus delivers the data based on those needs or capabilities. Now, if the data bus is not able to deliver the data, that's another benefit. It will also tell you that the desired capabilities or needs that you expressed weren't able to be met. So now, again, applications only interface to the data. So every app can speak its own language. Data bus maps languages to the CPU OS transport. So it's completely agnostic to what's running underneath the floor. It is fast, scalable, it's extremely reliable. So DDS is actually 100% open standard. That links many languages. We have C, C++, Java, Python, web integration services. So it understands complex data types and how to communicate them as well. And it scales across millions of data paths. So it enforces millisecond timing. It ensures reliability. It supports redundancy and selective filters on information. So much like you can query a data bus, you can also query a database. So if we go back to the RIG example, that's actually very good, because right now a lot of systems, the way they work, will say, are you still there? Are you still there? Or say, let's use a temperature example. So it's like you're 80 degrees, 80 degrees, 80 degrees, 80 degrees. Well, that's a lot of overhead and a lot of processing, when really what you're interested in is if the temperature alarm exceeds 80 degrees and goes to 90 degrees. So now I can remove all that polling logic from my application, and I can put a query on the data bus that says, hey, I'm interested in this piece of data. Tell me when this event happens, but don't tell me any other time. It's also important to understand that there's no servers. So what that means is there's no single point of failure. So as soon as you have a server, you have a lot of restrictions. You know, where does it go? How fast is it? What is the startup ordering of all these? It's a choke point, potentially. So we have load balancers, and we have different mechanical ways of taking care of that. But with a data bus, you don't have any of those issues. And the most important thing, again, is that there's no single point of failure. So today, in traditional control systems, if an issue happens, we can interlock or shut the system down. But if you look at it from a data-centric standpoint, if you're having issues, you may want to actually keep that part of the system running, because you're looking at the overall process. So even though there was an issue, we don't really want to interlock that out. We may need to do something to kind of mitigate that. So that's why in a lot of systems, they build override protection in there, so that the human who's actually facilitating the process can decide to override and then manually take the risk of violating the interlock. So the data bus, it decouples software like no other. And to decouple in both in a federated fashion, you need to be able to decouple in both space and time, and also provide flow. So you want to give each component of the system the ability to make deterministic decisions. So the DDS standard allows systems to configure what we call a quality of service on all the data entities. And QoS is a configurable policy that you can apply to local entities in the system. And you usually do that for things like resource usage. And then you can also configure the end-to-end points, and you do this for to control spatial or the temporal qualities of the entity. So history is something that actually becomes very interesting, because in a lot of these industrial systems today, because they're monolithic systems, we push everything to a centralized historian. Well, the historian still can play an important role in future systems. It's more important to give the autonomous components of the system their ability to control and look at history in different ways. So if I'm a low-level part of the control system, I may need to look at every – I may want to keep historically like every event or a data sample that's been produced over the last 24 hours. And maybe I want to do that for liability reasons or some kind of risk mitigation. But I actually don't need, as I move up higher to a process level and then up to an enterprise level, I don't actually need to keep all of that data. So what we do typically is you start to downfilter that data. So instead of maybe once every 100 milliseconds, you're just keeping 1 second. And then maybe by the time you get to the enterprise level, you're just keeping one sample every 10 seconds. So by allowing the historical properties of the data bus to reside within the individual components of the system, you can allow each part of the system to independently configure and control its own perception of history. And since systems are all about data, decoupled subsystems can now work independently, and data-centric sharing lets them cooperate. So now what DBS allows you to do, which is actually RTI's motto is that your system can now work as one. And the biggest benefit that you can get from this is a decoupled system, because it allows you to focus on the functional and non-functional requirements of a system. The non-functional requirements are things like reliability, redundancy, scalability, and then we know what the functional components are. But so one question we like to ask at RTI is if these are the five questions that you should always ask if you need a data bus or RTI actually to help you solve your problems. So are there severe consequences of failure for a few minutes or seconds? Have you said milliseconds in the last 2 weeks? Do you have more than 10 software engineers? Does your data have many destinations? And are you building a next generation IIoT design? So what we like to say is if you answer yes to three or more of these, then you probably need a data bus for your architecture. So that's the end of that presentation. If you go to our website, we do have a full version of Connect DBS, which you can get an evaluation license for 30 days. You can download it. I believe it gives you access to Professional, which is a set of tools, as well as the libraries. And I believe that's for Linux and Windows. Yeah, thank you. So let's stay connected. My name again is Mark Carrier. If you want to reach out to me, you can get me at markc@rti.com. Or any other questions, we have podcasts, blogs, a whole community. We have GitHub online, so there's a lot of stuff out there about RTI and about DDS. So, Kurt, back to you.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Lots of great information there. We are now to the audience Q&A. Want to remind our viewers to continue to ask questions, take advantage of the expertise we have here, and continue to ask questions. Let's start with this one. So how does DDS compare to other industrial IoT communications frameworks? And they mentioned things like MQTT, OPC, ActiveMQ, which I think you had a slide on. How do those relate?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So like I was explaining before, so DDS is it's really the next evolution of networking technology. So all those other technologies and all those other paradigms that we talked about, like point-to-point, client-server, publish-subscribe, queuing, they're all very valid ways of communicating. And they're also in a complex system, you may actually end up needing all of those different protocols. But when you're starting to integrate all the components together, the only where DDS really differentiates itself is that it no longer looks at messages in a system. It actually looks at the data in the system. So instead of sending a message from point A to point B, and a good example would really be like imagine an enterprise calendar that most of us probably use every day, probably more than we like. Imagine if you tried to schedule or even this webinar online, but you did it through email instead of through the enterprise calendaring program. So what would happen if you left work on Friday, you invited 20 people to a meeting on Monday morning, and then there were a bunch of emails going back and forth trying to propose a new time, adjust the agenda, adding new people. So by the time you get to work on Monday, because this is very message-centric, you have to sit down and you got to go through all of those different emails to try to reconstruct the state events on the calendar invite. And you may have been left out of a few of those events. You may not, or I'm sorry, emails. You may not actually received. Maybe you came in very late in the thread, or you were kind of abandoned partway through the thread. So because you lack all that state information, you don't really know when the meeting is. You probably have a pretty good idea, but if you look at the calendar, it's actually an event. So anytime any state changes to that, everybody is seeing that one true truth of the meeting. So that's really the difference between DBS and the other technologies.
Right. I think that's a good analogy in terms of just it's a paradigm shift, really. It's kind of a paradigm shift to data orientation, like you mentioned. So has DDS been deployed in any oil and gas architectures?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we're seeing a lot of customers are actually starting to redesign their systems because of the ease of integration. So a lot of these systems, like I said, they're engineered. They're not software architectures. But people are starting to see, I can't talk about a lot of them, but one company that I can mention, Ensign Energy, and that's also in my bio. So they have a brand new control system that they developed, which is actually uses a lot of the same paradigms. But when they went to add the next layer on top of that, which was to start to develop the process automation layer, they looked around at a bunch of different technologies and a bunch of different protocols, but they came up with the conclusion that they weren't going to be able to accomplish their goal using message-based systems. It had to be something that allowed them to share state information about data, because that's really what the process level and the enterprise level are all about.
Okay, let's see here. Can the data bus be extended to connect and interact with things adjacent to direct oil field components, like, for example, fluctuations in the oil productions might be linked to future refinement processes in the refinery that might indicate, you know, well, next week we better ramp up our production or lower our production or what have you. Can you extend the data bus beyond kind of what you mentioned in your presentation?
Yes, absolutely. And that, to be honest, that's actually kind of my dream of the digital oil field. So it kind of, right now we see growth starting in the upstream market. And I think once DDS is in systems in both the midstream and the downstream markets, then what you have is that data bus, which spans from production, from the E&P, all the way down to refinement. So in essence, if you had everything connected through the data bus using DDS, you could actually track a volume of oil as it is pulled from the ground, as it's processed, shipped through the pipeline, and at the refinery. So, yes, that's actually, I think, even a much larger picture of the digital oil field than I had presented there.
Okay.
So that's actually where I would like to see things go.
Right, maybe even right to the gas pump. When you, like, insert your credit card, it sends a signal for the oil field or something. All right. How about this? How does DDS relate to network topologies? So can it run over wired networks? Is it specific to Ethernet and IP, wireless? And how does it deal with different network speeds and reliability issues? I'm sure that's an issue with oil rigs and how they're actually connected, the networks themselves, between an oil rig and these other entities.
Yes, that's a great question. So DDS is transport agnostic.
Okay.
We sit above the transport layer. So we run over radio signals, you can go over wireless, TCP, serial, any way that you can communicate data from one source to a destination, you can utilize DDS on top of that. In fact, years ago, and that's all done through this quality of service, which is what the data bus provides.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the exact details of it, but RTI was involved in I think it was a rover project. So they wanted reliability, but the round trip time on those radio signals, I think, was like 3 minutes each way. So there was a lot of work that went into the transport layer to give deterministic round trip time so you could get real time reliability out of 3 minutes round trip time.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I guess it's taking the characteristics of the physical layer topology into account in order to still meet the delivery deadlines that are specified for the data. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. That's a perfect way to say that.
Neat. Here's an excellent question. So oil and gas being engineering intensive and DDS is software-based, what kinds of challenges can be foreseen in the transformation process, and what are your recommendations on how to best address these issues? So, and of course, how is your engagement process? How does it help these customers that, you know, may not be familiar with a lot of the, you know, technology behind software-driven DDS and communication systems into this new industrial IoT environment?
Yeah, so that is a very good question. It's exactly like you said earlier. It is a paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I threw that slide in there in the beginning about the disruption of software, and software is eating the world, because, yes, typically a lot of these large legacy systems are all engineered. But the truth is the complexity of these systems have grown so much that now in the new paradigms and new architectural technologies exist that you can actually turn around and start to implement this in software versus engineering. So this is one thing that's being looked at in the downstream right now. There's an organization called OPATH, the Open Process Automation Forum. They're looking at how to take distributed control systems to avoid vendor lock-in and apply more software-driven concepts so that they can achieve this edge autonomy. And it's really a paradigm shift, and some people are very open to it. Some people are not.
Right.
So how you engage the process to help customers, I think what you do is you really show them, especially in this industry, integration. Integration is one of the hardest things. To put an algorithm out on a rig may require buying additional hardware, getting engineering hours to mount that hardware, learning what the I/O points are so that when you hook up to it, you're getting the right data feed. But the problem is what you've done, you've solved a problem for a point installation. Now when I go to another rig, which may be an operator running rig A and rig B, but it may be a different contractor. So they're going to have completely different I/O. They're going to have they may not even have some of the automated features that you're looking for, or not even the I/O that you're looking for. So now instead of looking at things in terms of I/O, you're actually looking at it in terms of data. And if you can start to show a customer how easy it is to turn an engineered solution into a software solution, because a lot of these algorithms are, at the end of the day, it's an algorithm anyway, and it's running on software. But you've spent a majority of your time trying to engineer the process as opposed to just installing the application and letting it run.
Right. So I guess do you or your FAEs fly out and kind of say, here's the situation, then you kind of help with the paradigm shift by saying, well, here's your data model and here's how it works and here's how you can apply DDS? Does it go that far? Do you do consulting?
Yeah, well, we don't do consulting, but we do. We have FAEs. We have a service organization. Our service organization does architectural studies. So they'll come out and just like you said, they'll look at your system and kind of make some recommendations about how you can start to decouple and decentralize it. And what we find out as well is once people go down this path, they actually end up restructuring their teams. So the services we also provide, like besides architectural, we'll provide more detailed, and you can buy engineering hours from us where we'll come in and, train you, maybe spend a significant amount of time helping you to implement parts of your system that are the DDS related. So, yeah, we don't do consulting, but we do have a huge support effort.
Got it. Okay. So it's more than just dropping the software module off then, at least. So that's good. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time today. I want to thank Mark for sharing your insights on data centricity and the oil drilling processes therein. We at Open Systems Media and RTI want to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing excellent questions today. This eCast will be posted online at the URL on your screen in 24 hours. Note that an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded, space, e-cast, and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download there as MP3s. Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thanks for attending, and have a great day.